itself, because when these companies presented it to, you know, these monitoring focus groups, people said, heck no, I don't want this, because there's no benefit for you and I, the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
It's all to allow companies to maintain control of their products, but also market and research to monitor how we use products so that they can sell us more. This is the total surveillance society technology. That I'm not saying that this is the mark of the beast, because it's not. What I'm saying is that something like this, a future generation of this technology that is introduced for economic reasons, could at some point in the future be used by a dictatorial government of the Antichrist to implement the mark of the beast by simply at that point saying, worship the Antichrist as God. And if you do, we'll add 666 to the number you already have. And if you don't, we're coming after you.
Well, it's interesting because you have to have a supremely powerful and comprehensive computer system to be able to handle the mind-boggling permutations and combinations of information and connectivity.
Absolutely.
And just in the last month or so, an announcement came out that a company in Israel has just produced a chip that will multiply the power of the computer 100-fold.
Absolutely. And not only that, the Israel Paper Company has most of these chips, the billions that exist already, Chuck, do not have a battery. They're passive. You, from the radio scanner, about the size of a flashlight,
mm-hmm.
about $250, it sends out a radio signal that bounces back. But the Israeli paper company developed a technology of incredibly small batteries that can be attached to these little chips the size of a period at the end of a sentence, and they can now, with a battery, be read by a helicopter, a plane, or a satellite from miles away.
Wow.
In space.
Well, there is so much more that we could talk about, including the mandatory chips in every vehicle manufactured now in the United States of America.
Indeed.
To enable government to track every single human being driving a vehicle. Also, the mandatory chipping of every animal in this country, so that any source of animal food will be trackable and governable. And then also the mandate of bringing all growing of vegetables and food products under government control. It's all there. It's all coming into picture. Okay, we've got this unbelievably overwhelming, growing body of information that is revealing that the prophecies of ancient scripture are indeed true. They are coming together, but it's not for sensationalizing. It's for helping us to get ready to realize, to put a framework around our lives and realize that we cannot continue as business as usual like the people in Noah's day. We have got to be sort of building an ark in our lives. We've got to get serious about our faith. We've got to repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, don't we?
You're absolutely right, and we need to respond to this not with fear and gloom,
right,
but rather recognize that this is exactly what Jesus said would happen.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible says that when we see these things begin to come to pass in Luke 21:28, we are to look up, because our redemption is drawing nigh. This should motivate us, Chuck, to witness. And it should motivate us to walk in holiness in an immoral world.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not trying to be alarmist or doom and gloom, but to say, look, friends, we are approaching the crisis of human history spoken of by the prophets and Jesus Christ. We need to become serious about our commitment to Jesus Christ and to share our faith with others while there's still time. The last chapter of my book, in the last 5 minutes of the documentary, share the plan of salvation. because ultimately the ultimate issue is, what is your attitude and relationship to Jesus Christ?
And God, the scriptures make it very plain that without holiness, no man shall see the Lord.
Absolutely.
God isn't playing games. He's not looking for cheap grace. He's not looking for a cheap confession. He's looking for people who are living their lives in full confidence and in full trust upon the blood of Christ and his salvation. And friend, I hope that's you. And if not, I urge you to repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Confess your sin. Come clean before God. Embrace Jesus Christ as your Lord and your Savior and begin to walk with Him in joy from this day forward. A big thank you to Grant Jeffrey for joining us. And friends, again, the book Shadow Government or the DVD Shadow Government. The book is $14. The DVD is $18. Or if you'd like both of them, your combined gift of $30 to Save America Ministries. Only one $4 postage and handling. Call us 1-800-SAVE-USA. Write to us or get it on our website, saveus.org. And I want to urge you, and I do mean urge you, to become a partner with us. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Prepare the way of the Lord.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crossmeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be those of Kirk McKenzie. And we've had Kirk on before talking about his book, but I never had a chance to read his book. I just got it in the mail. And I think it's probably worthwhile going over again because he's got a lot of great information here. Hi, Kirk. How are we doing?
Well, fine. Thank you for having me back on.
Well, I think it's important that people really understand what is going on today because, of course, we have a book we carry. It's called The Coming Battle. It was written, 111 years ago by a fellow named Mr. Walther. And he says, you know, the banks are going to try to take over control of the American government. That was 111 years ago. And today they do control the American government. The Federal Reserve System determines what happens to the economic policies of this nation, whether we have prosperity, whether we have recession, whether we have depression. Certainly, and they control the monetary system of our country and the future of everybody listening to this program. The Fed is controlled. It's a privately owned central bank. It's owned by the six major banks, and some of the smaller banks have a stock in it, but it is primarily controlled by the major financial bases in this country. Six major banks really control the Fed, and the Fed controls our nation. And, of course, if you go into the history, and, of course, Keith does this, Kirk does this very, very well, he points out, you know, there was an effort to assassinate Andrew Jackson because he opposed the central bankers at that time. And then that was the second Bank of the United States. And then, of course, Abraham Lincoln opposed the banking system, and he was executed. Garfield opposed the bankers. He was executed. President McKinley opposed the banker system, and he was executed. And, of course, John Kennedy, one of his great sins was he wanted, of course, to have a silver-backed currency. He had an executive order to do that, and not too long after that, he was executed. And people, oh, well, that's just coincidence. But do you really think it's coincidence, Kirk, or do you believe that these people will stop at nothing? Their ultimate goal is power.
Well, I believe that they'll not stop at nothing as far as the correlation between the banking acts and the extensions of the charter periods and so forth. It is a fact that the assassinations strongly correlate to those events. Now, it is opinion, not fact, as to whether that ties in or not, if it were a single isolated event, I think it would be very difficult to come to any different conclusion that we have historically. But when one looks at the overall totality of the information and sees this correlation, I think it's pretty hard, in my opinion, to not at least come to the conclusion that there needs to be a strong investigation on the basis that perhaps these are tied to the monetary system and the money power. I certainly believe that there is a fit.
All right, fine. Well, now, you really, in your book, you go into certainly the power of Goldman Sachs. I don't think most people understand that Goldman Sachs is certainly one of the probably two or three most powerful banks in the country, and some people even refer to them as Government Sachs, because so many of their people are in key positions in our government, including Henry Paulson, who certainly was Secretary of the Treasury when they had to have the TARP legislation. They told us that if we didn't give it to them, there was going to be riots, and Congress still voted against it, then in violation of all the laws of Congress, because you can't bring back a law, you know, until the next session, if it's been defeated. They brought it back 4 days later with about $50 billion in bribes for the congressmen and threats of martial law on Monday if people didn't switch their votes. And they got about 25 congressmen to switch their votes. And they got the money supposedly to give to Main Street, and then Henry Paulson from Goldman Sachs changed his mind and gave it to his buddies on Wall Street so we could get the economy moving, get the banks lending. But they didn't lend, and they've consistently refused to lend to get our economy going. They know what they're doing. It's just the tragedy is the average individual doesn't.
You go right ahead
and tell the story.
Well, I agree. I mean, that the main thing to understand really quite fully is there's a timeline in the book. I'll leave that to the readers to go through the timeline. But let me just name some names here that's going on in this period of time. Is we have Henry Paulson, who's the Secretary of the U.S. Treasury. He's from Goldman Sachs. He was an executive there.
He was the CEO, actually.
That's correct. And his undersecretary was Gary Gensler, also from Goldman Sachs. The czar that was put in charge of TARP was Neil Kashkari. He was at Goldman Sachs. The CEO of AIG, who was in the center of this, was Edward Liddy. He was Goldman Sachs. The person who replaced Timothy Geithner as the president of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York is Stephen Friedman. He's Goldman Sachs. And even Barney Frank's top staffer in the House Ways and Means Committee, Michael Pease, leaves his position in the public and joins Goldman Sachs. And if you trace this, you see basically a consistent flow of people from Goldman Sachs into government, and then a flow of money from government back to Goldman Sachs.
And I think this is really so important to understand. This doesn't happen by accident. You're supposed to have people employed by government who, you know, are there to serve the government and serve the people. And here's Henry Paulson came up a job that was paying him, I think, $30 to $40 million a year. $30 to $40 million a year as CEO of Goldman Sachs. Plus, of course, he'd get all these stock benefits and option benefits. He gives that up to take a job working for as the Secretary of the Treasury at $180 million a year. Well, you know, you've really got to be dedicated to public service to do that, unless he's going to use that position to funnel countless billions of dollars to Goldman Sachs and the other major banks, which is exactly what he did. And to AIG, his buddies in AIG, and of course then the AIG could act as a conduit for the money to go directly to Goldman Sachs so they could continue paying their truly obscene bonuses. And I say there's nothing wrong with an honest salary, but when you're putting out somewhere between $12 and $26 billion for bonuses, I somehow don't think that's quite kosher, especially when that's money from American tax dollars, though it is American money given to AIG with the full consent of Mr. Paulson and then funneled on to his friends at Goldman Sachs. Do you think there might have been a little skullduggery going on there?
Certainly, there's no question about it. I mean, if you start to tally the numbers, let's just kind of tally the amount of money that flows to Goldman Sachs. They received $10 billion from TARP, $13 billion from AIG, $28 billion from FDIC.
Hold that thought, and we'll be right back here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Kirk McKenzie has written a book. It's entitled Money, Defending Your Prosperity. And I recommend you read it. We're not carrying it just yet, but right now, of course, I think it's got a lot of great information. And it goes into the fact that, you know, there's so many people from Goldman Sachs go into our government, and then in those positions, they manage to funnel money back to Goldman Sachs. Now, you know, are we paranoid? What you were just giving us, the how some of this money has gone from the United States government to Goldman Sachs, were there people in key positions in both the Bush and Obama administration? Would you just start from the very beginning about how that money
sure.
went?
So let's just kind of follow this. So we have $10 billion from TARP, and let's recall that TARP is being headed by former Goldman Sachs executive Neil Kashkari, who's the czar. $13 billion from AIG, and the CEO of AIG was Edward Liddy, a former Goldman Sachs person. They received $28 billion from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. They received $11 billion from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and the president of that becomes Steven Friedman, a Goldman Sachs person. And interestingly enough, they received $5 billion from Warren Buffett. So they received massive sums of money. And then what do they do? And with that money, they do not turn around and put it into the economy. Instead, they speculate. And so they buy stock at distressed prices. They buy 10% of the Chicago Climate Exchange. You know, this all ties into the global warming debate. And they buy $1 billion in carbon assets and make record profits.
And the amazing thing about this, they're speculating on the stock market, and they're making money 29 out of 30 days. It's somewhere like that. You know, I think they lost money one day in a couple of months, something like that. You can't do that in the stock market, not unless the stock market's rigged. How could they be so much smarter than anybody else? Or maybe the stock market is rigged, or maybe they're the ones who rig it. But, I mean, these vast sums of money going to Goldman Sachs, and they're not the only ones. And J.P. Morgan Chase got their greedy little hands on a lot of the money. Oh, but, of course, this is the tax money, the future of this generation and generations unborn. I think we're seeing the greatest transfer of wealth that has ever taken place in all history, taking place in the last couple of years, as America's wealth has been funneled to the major banks, who are responsible for this whole thing, because basically what they're doing is they're just not making loans. They've got plenty of money, but they want to precipitate the crisis. This is what they've done time and again. They did it. They sent me back and read Kirk's book, and it happened during the Jackson administration. It happened, you know, in the 1870s and the 1890s and 1907. It happened certainly in the 1920. It happened again in 1929. They play this game over and over, don't they?
They do. There's a playbook. It's like a football team has a playbook, and once you really... This is why, you know, I used to hate history as a child. I have to tell you, that was my most boring class. I saw no relevance to it whatsoever. But I tell you what, when you dig in and try to understand the world, if nothing else, the most fascinating and suspenseful and the mystery is actually in understanding the truth and the real history of the world. And so when you dig into this, you begin to see that these rules and these games are just being played on us again and again. You know, so for example, the bank panic of 1907, which you refer to, was used as the justification to reform the monetary system, which resulted in the creation of the Federal Reserve System. Well, guess what? This last crash, they're manufactured by the banks and their policies, and then what happens? The Federal Reserve is given even more powers. I mean, the rule book, the rules of the games just keep being played over and over again, and it's because of the ignorance of the people and the fact they pretty much own the media, in my opinion. Getting back to your point about speculation and their profits they make, I think when you set financial policy and you control the monetary system and you have your people doing that, I don't think there's much speculation involved.
The difficulty is people, you know, well, we pass new legislation so we can, you know, stop these things from happening again. Who did we give the responsibility to? Who's going to run it? Why, the Federal Reserve System is going to be running it. And, of course, the major banks were responsible. And the Federal Reserve is owned. It's a privately owned bank. It's owned by the very banks that it's supposed to regulate. How many people out there in the audience, hold up your hands, really honestly believe that the Federal Reserve, which is owned by the major banks, is going to regulate those banks for the benefit of the public? Ladies and gentlemen, there's no better way to destroy a nation other than, of course, to destroy the monetary base of that nation. These people involved in the major banks, they all tie into Council on Foreign Relations, Bilderbergers, and their dedication is not to America. It's to a globalist dream of a new world order, a new world religion, a new world society under a ruling aristocracy. And Professor Quigley talked about that in his book on page 324, 325, Tragedy and Hope, how the banks work together in secret meetings, working to create a new feudal society. Well, that, of course, is a return to serfdom with a ruling aristocracy, and, of course, those are the bankers. But go right ahead, Sydney. How did you get interested in this, Kirk? What motivated you to put this information together and put out a book? And you have a little pamphlet here as well as a lot of great information, great quotations.
Well, let me, before I'll answer your question, before that, I want to pick up on one little point you met. Really was about the way that you take over countries and you take over the world and you end liberties. Is a quote from John Maynard Keynes. Quote, there is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to botch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction and does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose. I started my journey into this whole thing about 20 years ago, and it wasn't because I had any of this information to me whatsoever. It was because I'm old enough to have heard everything on the news, on television. You know, we have problems with our education system. We have problems with tax rates. We have problems with deficits and debts. And everywhere you look, we have problems. And any 10 Americans could sit in a room for an hour and come up with good solutions to those. And yet Congress does not seem to be able to pass those solutions. In fact, it only gets worse. And what gravely concerned me was the debt our country was facing at that time. And so I decided to set aside the notion that our country is just kind of drifting by some kind of natural force of nature in the direction it's going, and instead kind of open my considerations to the idea that perhaps we're being driven in a given direction. And I decided, because of my concerns about debt, to follow the money. And that turns out to be the pivotal role. I don't care whether you start with education, you start with drugs, you start with politics, you start with the inflation, any of the things that concern us. If you study the topic long enough, you will come to the realization that ties back to the question of the control of the monetary system.
I will never forget, it was about 31 years ago, 1980, when I had an opportunity of interviewing Norman Dodd, who had been director of research for the Reese Committee, which had studied and evaluated the great tax-exempt foundations back in 1953 and 1954. And I said to him, Norman, I mean, how did the banks take over the how did the great foundations take over the educational system? How did they take over our universities? And I thought he was going to tell me, you know, they gave them, grants and various and sundry thing and put their people into key positions. And he looked at me and said, through the fractional reserve banking system. Well, you know, of course, you really don't want to admit you don't know what somebody's talking about, but I had no idea what in heaven's name he was talking about. How could the great foundations have taken over our educational system through the fractional reserve banking system? Well, you learn a lot. You get older and you hope you get smarter. Could you explain to our listeners what the fractional reserve banking system is and how the people of great wealth have been able to utilize that, not only to get richer, but certainly to be able to buy up our universities, to buy up our media, to buy up our corporations, and to purchase some of the finest politicians that money could buy?
Well, it's a Ponzi scheme. I mean, really what it is let's go back to the days when we were following the Constitution, then currency was either gold or silver. For every gold dollar, you could make up 9 paper dollars and lend them out at interest. So all you had to have was a printing press, and you could go out there and lend these things out to people. Now, it's not quite that simple, but let's just kind of keep the main thing here. So a fractional reserve system is really should be considered as a different term probably should be used. This is simply creating a lot of fake money on the basis of, 10% of it being real, and then making tremendous profits on this. The the other corollary issue of this, by taking control of the issuance of money and having a monopoly control on it, bankers will only issue currency if somebody borrows it. And this is the other pivotal aspect of the system. So the only way that a nation can get money under the current system is that either the federal government, state government, local government, corporation, or individuals have to borrow it. And it becomes impossible to pay these debts off. And so between the ability to just kind of make money from nothing and to then, you know, lend this out at interest and make money on that, they have become extremely rich and as a result extremely powerful. And I've been recently involved in two discussions. One was on the takeover of private property rights by the United Nations here in the United States. There were active efforts in cities across the country with fancy sounding terminology, but essentially as part of Agenda 21 to begin to establish global government over local property. And the presenter at that eventually concludes in his speech that it tracks back to the money power. And of course, you're probably familiar with Cheryl Iserbeit and her pursuit of understanding the education and the dumbing down of America. And she also traces this back to the money system. I don't care what issue you start with. If you study it long enough, you're going to come back to the same core group of people. And what empowers them is the ability to create money from nothing.
And I think people have to understand the treasury. At one time, we had to have gold backing behind our currency so they couldn't print as much as they want to when we went off the gold standard in 1971. Now they could print all the money they wanted to. But that the banks could also create money. It's not really money. They call it credit. But for every dollar they have in deposit, they can lend out $10 or $20 or $30 or $40 if they're an investment bank. And that's how you create money out of nothing.
That's correct.
Go right ahead.
Well, I think that one thing that would be, you know, truth in lending, if we want to get into being truthful about things, when this nation was formed, it was called the U.S. Treasury because it was a treasury. It held.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work, it's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verki water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verki water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 3:16 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
Or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-2295. But in the little booklet, he has a quotation from John Maynard Keynes. By a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate secretly and unobserved an important part of the wealth of their citizens. There is no subtler nor surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of the economic law on the side of destruction, and does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose. And I think that is so, so true. And then, of course, the quotations here from Lewis McFadden, who was the chairman of the House Banking Committee for many years. And his writings are so vitally important. You need to read them to understand that he's writing back in 1933 and 1934. There have been a number of attempts on his life, and he eventually died, and many people believe he was killed. But he talked about the Federal Reserve banks are one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever seen. Now, he's writing in 1933, 1934. There's not a man within the sound of my voice who does not know that the nation is run by the international bankers. Some people think the Federal Reserve banks are U.S. government institutions. They're not. They're private credit monopolies which prey upon the people of the United States for the benefit of themselves and their foreign and domestic swindlers and rich and predatory moneylenders. The sack of the United States by the Federal Reserve is the greatest crime in history. Every effort has to be made by the Fed to conceal its powers, but the truth is the Fed has usurped the government. It controls everything here, and it controls all our foreign relations. It makes and breaks governments at will. And certainly he gave so many speeches before. You'll find some of them up on the our internet site, where we simply have taken Congressman McFadden's information and just put it out there for you can read it. As he tries pleading to get the American people to understand what's happening, and then time and time again why the attempts on his life, and then he dies just a couple of years after that's been written. And many, many people believe he was killed.
And I think that's an important distinction to make. He's not just writing this. This is a speech he's giving to the U.S. Congress. I think that most Americans cling on to the idea that somehow the folks in Washington, D.C. are well-intended, but, gee, they have a few differences of opinions, or they just don't understand, or, they're a little stupid, or whatever else. I think we have to abandon those notions and come to the realization that people in Washington, D.C. do understand things. And therefore, we have to begin to understand who's on our side and on the side of the Constitution and who's not.
And that's really what it's all about. I mean, we have a lot of people, a lot of prostitutes who've sold their votes to the international bankers, and there are other people who are out there trying to get the information out. You will never hear them quoted in the major newspapers. Certainly Ron Paul is one of those people who's constantly getting out information, and he's accomplished a great deal simply by himself. But people must understand that when you turn on your television, who do we ordinarily see as the spokesman for the Republican Party? Why, Senator John McCain. Who is Senator John McCain? He's the most liberal senator in the Republican Party. He was a traitor. He actually betrayed his fellow prisoners when he was a prisoner of war over there. He had all sorts of affairs with women over there, and they have all the videotapes of that. But, of course, you're never going to hear that mentioned by the controlled media here in the United States. But he was a traitor. He even made propaganda films for the North Vietnamese. None of his other people would do that, but John McCain did. And that's why he is the United States Senator from Arizona, with the full support of the controlled media. And this is what a tragedy it is, that he is the one you always hear speaking for the Republican Party. You don't hear somebody like, say, Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma City, a true conservative. Now, no, you hear the people they want you to hear, and the rest of the people, those who are really working to try to preserve America, are never mentioned. Have you noticed that, Kirk?
I have, and I think you make a great point, because this is another thing that we have to change, is the idea that we're going to depend upon the people that appear on television as the people from which we form our ideas. We have got to start relying on each other, and a show like yours is an excellent form for the truth to get through.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two. If you have a question or comment for our guests, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. This is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is Kirk McKenzie. And Kirk, I really like this little pamphlet you've got. There's a little booklet. Have you been able to move that fairly well?
Yeah, and if you're interested, we can work on that. The booklet is, for the audience to know, it's basically a little pocketbook. It's about 60 pages long. And what it contains is photographs and quotes from famous people, pretty much in historical sequence, starting with the founding of the Constitution and moving on forward. And it does not give you the detail and the explanation that the book will give you of the depth of knowledge. But once you understand that depth, this is excellent to carry around and show other people and to refer to. One of the quotes here that further connects the bankers with world governments is a speech made by James Paul Warburg. He's the son of Paul Warburg, who was the chief architect of the Federal Reserve Act. And again, this is right talking to the U.S. Senate. This is not, in secret. The American people don't know about it, but he's right in front of the U.S. Senate, February 17, 1950, telling them, "We shall have world government, whether or not we like it. The only question is whether world government will be achieved by conquest or consent."
And that's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. It's all about a world government. That is the major purpose behind everything going on today. This is the reason why we have, of course, our troop station in 130 to 140 nations. Why do we have troop station in 130 or more nations throughout the world today? Because the ultimate purpose of American foreign policy is world government. We have 720 military bases throughout the world. Who are we defending ourselves against? I mean, we're doing everything we can to help the Russians. We're building up communist China. We're intensively allowing them to accumulate massive financial reserves. And we're actually subsidizing the companies that go over there with lower tax rates. Now, why are we building up communist China? Because nothing is it appears to be. And people must understand the ultimate goal is a world government. And we have our agents planted in governments all throughout the world. Because behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces fulfilling the ancient dream of a one world government. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Kirk McKenzie. And Kirk, would you like to get your website out and tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Sure. The website is www.silentnomorepublications.com.
Silentnomorepublications.com. Okay, fine. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for our guest, give us a call. Well, let's go to Mike calling in from Michigan. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Very good, Dr. Stan.
Well, are you in Flint or in Detroit? Whereabouts?
No, I'm in West Michigan, up in the Hesperia area.
Okay, fine. You're listening on the Internet or shortwave?
I'm shortwave.
Okay, go ahead.
My question is this. If we're looking at this as a rigged game, let's say that, for instance, everybody or the majority of the people in the United States said, stood up and said no more, and we were to maybe bring a halt to it in this country, yet that it would be rigged around the world to then destroy us or destroy what we're doing, because the Federal Reserve is the money. I mean, you can't really take these people out of the game and yet still have things going. My question is, is there a possibility of introducing another dollar, another type of currency that would be introduced by people, and a second product, if you would?
How would you answer that?
I think the answer to your question, Mike, is first is your concern is a legitimate concern, because as long as there's a central bank in any country in the world, you know, they can draw upon that to influence every other country. There's no question about that. And they've done that with the Federal Reserve in terms of using that money and, unfortunately, innocent Americans in kind of having a 100-year rampage against the world changing things. As far as having another currency, your answer is absolutely yes. Not only can we do so, we must do so. And JFK tried. Executive Order 11,110. He authorized the U.S. Treasury to begin printing what Abraham Lincoln started to print in 1862. These are called leaker tender notes or U.S. notes. And what they are is a government paper currency that the government issues directly into the economy, bypassing the Federal Reserve. They don't borrow it. They don't pay any interest on it. They pay it directly into the economy. And that only lasted 5 months before Kennedy was assassinated. But that was a direct assault on the financial monetary power, and it was, in fact, one of the principal solutions that's been proposed to solving these problems. And if you go back to the Hazard Circular back in roughly 1860, I'll find that quote in a second, it actually tells you exactly this. The key to getting us back to being a prosperous and free people again is the ability of the government issue a debt-free, interest-free currency. And here's the quote. 1862, the London Times is basically paraphrasing what's called the Hazard Circular in July 1862. To give you a frame of reference, 1862, Civil War, we're now in the second type of paper money. The demand notes that were authorized in 1861 didn't work out. They have now passed an act authorizing these legal tender notes. This is a year before the next year we're going to find that they actually now put this back into the hands of the private bankers through the National Bank Act. But in 1862, it's the federal government issuing a currency that cannot be redeemed. Quote, if that mischievous financial policy, which had its origins in the North American Republic, should become integrated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off its debt and be without a debt. It will become prosperous beyond precedent in the history of the civilized governments of the world. The brains and wealth of all countries will go to North America. That government must be destroyed. It will destroy every monarchy on the globe. So there is clear history and precedent that all it takes is a president, because the power exists already. It does not take a constitutional amendment.
All right, does that answer your question?
That sure does.
And basically, of course, this whole thing, I believe, is going to crumble. I think that they're going to have to print more and more and more money. And as they do that, they destroy the value of the currency. How far this will go, I hope it doesn't go as far as it did in Zimbabwe or the Weimar Republic. Hopefully, we'll get it stopped before everybody loses their whole entire life savings. You know, and Social Security is bankrupt. Why, Medicare is bankrupt. The FDIC is bankrupt. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are bankrupt. Everything going on today, many of our states, our cities, our counties are bankrupt. They have no way possibly of paying back all the money they owe. And there's going to be a serious financial collapse. And then maybe we can start in all over again if we still have an element of freedom. That's what it depends on. Okay. Thanks very much. Appreciate your calling.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
And let's go to Ron calling from Western Washington. Our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And hi, Ron, do you have a question or comment?
Well, I'm from Eastern Washington, but...
You're Eastern Washington. I'm sorry. Well, go ahead.
No, it's all right. Just a couple of comments. If they really do debase the currency and they start throwing money around from helicopters, then I'll finally become a millionaire. I always wanted to be a millionaire. Of course, it won't be worth anything.
That's right.
In fact, if you had four $250 trillion Zimbabwean notes, you could be a quadrillionaire.
You could be, but you couldn't buy very much with them. In fact, they just quit using the money. They've gone back to using the American dollar as the standard currency in Zimbabwe. I think that and the South African rand. Because even though neither one of them are terribly good, they're sure better than the Zimbabwean dollars. Anyway, did you have a question or comment for our guest?
Well, I think there's one fallacy in your argument, and that's that, if the American people know the truth, they're going to do something about it. Well, I think there's a large percentage that will be, but I guarantee you there's another large percentage. They look to government as government. Who's going to give the most to me? Or the government is best that buys votes with other people's money by giving money to deadbeats.
That's the old idea of robbing from Peter to pay Paul so that you can depend upon Paul's vote. But they've even got a better system today. They actually give money to both Peter and Paul because they just borrow money from future unborn generations. It's a great scam. What are your thoughts of it, Kirk, on what Ron is saying?
Well, it's a legitimate point. It's a race. I mean, bottom line, Ron, I mean, they've understood that for a long time, and so they've been building up the dependency base reducing the productive base as a proportion of it. You are correct. I think that part of it is we have to move fast. We have to be able to figure out how to communicate our message in a way that does not turn off the mass Americans, but basically actually will reach them, hit them mentally, let them get it without getting into conspiratorial theories and all the things that most people reject and cannot get into. It's not essential to get the message out there. And ultimately, I think we have to inform the government employees, the SIU union members, even people who are on the welfare rolls. We have to start getting out a message to let them know if this goes, you go. And if we're all in the same boat.
I'm on the phone right now. Yes, sir. One other thing. The churches, many of the churches seem to think that it's the business of government to provide for the citizenry, which I think is very contrary to the scriptures. And they would argue that these like national health care, which of course is a fraud, but they say, don't you care about taking care of others?
Well, you know, the answer to that is, of course, Medicare is bankrupt, and the reason that we have to have the national health care is so we can set up the death panels. Do you really want the government that is in the process now of killing innocent people in Afghanistan? They have their death squads over there in Afghanistan actually killing civilians over there. Do you really want that government determining what's best for your health when they don't have the money to provide? Right now, we have 54 million people on Medicare. And we've got another 70 million people, 70 to 74 million people going to be on Medicare within the next 20 years. What's going to happen if all those 54 million don't die off? There's no money. Medicare is bankrupt. There is no trust fund. Well, they're just going to have to kill off the elderly. They have something called end-of-life care in our hospitals today, and you ought to talk to people who work in the hospitals about what end-of-life care really involves in the hospitals across America today. It simply means of rescuing Medicare. I think they have to get people to understand that the life that's lost could be that one of their loved ones, because if there's no money to pay for it and government decides, do you really think they're going to be concerned about the elderly citizen just because they paid in all throughout their lifetime? And the answer is no. Oh, they're going to do what's expedient, and they're simply going to get rid of the elderly people. That's what the death panels are all about. And Obama said there were no death panels in the Obama health care bill, and that's right. The death panels were in the stimulus bill. Anything else, Ron?
Well,
I appreciate what you said. Hold
just a minute. Let Kirk go ahead.
Let me address Ron's question. It's another excellent question. The churches are AWOL, and I believe that the members of the churches have got to get proactive here and start kicking ministers and priests out who do not understand that they are AWOL at the most critical time. They are not doing God's work to build a system based on the theft of money from one person to give to somebody else. That is not God's work.
And well, I agree 100%. It's totally contrary to Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus said you give your own money and you don't make a big deal about it. Politicians give other people's money and they strut around and brag about being generous.
Furthermore, this is not going to make humanity better off if everybody becomes poor. So I think that people have to become very, in my opinion, there has to be a revolution within the membership of the churches themselves to rediscover their Christianity and understand that Christianity does not mean communism or socialism.
And what we need to do, of course, is have alternative systems of hospitals, because the hospitals we have today are ridiculously expensive. We need certainly to have the churches begin accepting responsibility for helping the people who really cannot help themselves. But those people who can help themselves should be required to work, and the idea of giving money to people who just will not go out and get a job. Why should anybody go out and get a job today when they get unemployment benefits, get half of what they were making before? And then they get food stamps. We have 41 or 42 million people on food stamps today. They get housing subsidies. They get free Medicare through Medicaid. Why bother to get a job? You wonder why we have such high unemployment. You get what you subsidize, and we're subsidizing people not to work. And so basically we have to import the people from south of the border because they'll work for lower wages. Well, people are going to have to learn to work for less. The utopian world we've known, I believe, is gone forever. We're going to see much lower living standards. What are your thoughts, Kirk?
Yes, I agree with all of that.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've sent 8 million jobs overseas, and they're not coming back. We've lost, 3 to 5 million jobs since the recession began about in 2007. And it's just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And more people are going to be out of work. And more people are going to lose their homes. And more businesses are going to close. Businesses are closing all across America today. And more businesses are going overseas because we're subsidizing them with lower tax rates if they move out of the country. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense, does it, Kirk?
No. Let's put it this way. It doesn't make sense from the perspective of people that have our values. But if you are standing in the position of a communist perspective, a socialist, a globalist perspective, then you begin to understand the sense, because they have every intent to begin to equalize the populations of the world. And in that formula, you have a few people that are doing reasonably well, that have the American dream, the Western civilization principally, being averaged against four or five or 6 billion people that are relatively poor, and the answer is we're all become poor. So it makes sense only from understanding the perspective from which they come from. If I could, I would like to mention that if I have a YouTube video on there called Why We Are in So Much Debt. Why We Are in So Much Debt. I encourage people to go look that up. It's a one-hour seminar that covers the two of the chapters in the book.
Well, why are we in so much debt?
It's pretty simple. You have a fractional reserve system, you have a debt monetization system, and you have a government that's pretty much controlled, in my opinion, from New York City, and with the monopoly control of the issuance of currency in the hands of a privately owned cartel, frankly. And, you know, in a synopsis, that's pretty much what it is. But, you know, you need to bring people, you know, those of us who understand can get that. But the majority of the population, 95% or the 99% that we have yet to reach, cannot get to that in a 5-second or a 10-second soundbite. It is impossible. They have to be walked through the logic and understand and see for themselves how the system, what it is, what it truly is, how it was put together, and then begin to address the questions of how we solve the problem.
Well, I think you've done an excellent job with your book. It's not too long. This is one of the big problems we have today. You have too big a book, people aren't going to read it. But I think people can readily read your book. You can certainly read the small little pocketbook, and then, of course, they can get through the rest of the thing. What you've done is simply take the bullet points and put them down so that people can see that certainly the banks really, for all intents and purposes, control the government. I thought that the section you had on Goldman Sachs and their grip on the reins of power in the financial system of our government, whether it be the First Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Secretary of the Treasury, the people surround the president, his economic advisors, so many of them are related in one way or another to Goldman Sachs or to people who are related to Goldman Sachs. And here, these people, you know, we're talking bonuses for the seniors, people there, somewhere between $12 and $26 billion. I think it was $26 billion a couple of years ago. With the economy being what it is, they've had to cut bonuses back this last year to a paltry $12 billion for the executives. I mean, that's pretty good pocket change, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's actually worth pointing out the little bit of the family intermarriage that goes on within the banking community, because it's very extensive. But just to kind of tie into the Goldman Sachs theme, you might be interested to know that Hillary Clinton's daughter, Chelsea, has married Mark Mazinski, essentially of Goldman Sachs.
And isn't Al Gore's daughter married to somebody from Kuhn Loeb, as I remember?
Not Kuhn Loeb Company, and no longer exists. That merged into American Express.
Okay. I mean, basically, people...
He married a descendant of Jacob Schiff.
Okay.
Who was of Kuhn Loeb Company. That is correct.
Right.
It's no longer for Loeb Company.
Okay, fine. And Richard Nixon's daughter married into this. These people give incest a bad name. These things are not happening by accident, because behind all of this, there are powerful spiritual forces that are directing the course of human affairs. We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up this first hour here at Radio Liberty. Well, Kirk, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Well, listen, I think, you know, it sounds to me like you have an informed audience. Mike and was it Ron, I appreciate it.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
The syllabus, and we recommend that you get this information. We have a talk we gave some years ago called The Financial Tsunami, and that, of course, has a syllabus, but it was probably 5 or 6 years ago, but it gives you the basic understanding of how it all works. What is M1? What is M2? What is M3? What's the fractional reserve system? What indeed is money? And where did these ideas come from? And where is it headed? And who's really running this whole thing? Well, of course, this thing is being run by a small little cabal. I call them the Brotherhood of Darkness. And they tie in, of course, to the Trilateral Commission. And you get the membership list of the Brotherhood of Darkness. And we actually have that in a syllabus form. That's different than the book itself. But, you look at the membership list of the Trilateral Commission. There's only 87 members, the North American chapter. And as of last year, why, here's the head of the Bank of Israel, the head of the Bank of Canada, the people's head of Goldman Sachs, and head of Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Diamond was a member, and of course the Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. They're all tied into the Council on Foreign Relations, which, of course, is the modern-day manifestation of the ancient secret society, well, not ancient, but the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created back in 1891. And if you haven't heard my discussion of these issues, you need to get them. You need to get the Brotherhood of Darkness. And then you need to go up on the Internet and read my newsletters at RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com. Of course, we hope you'll want to subscribe to the newsletter, join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and help us. But if you're not in a position to do it, you can actually watch my Brotherhood of Darkness talk on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. You can read our newsletters, get the information, and then help us get it out. That's your job, because we have to have the majority of the American people understanding what's going on. We've got to break the control that exists today over their minds. Well, remember our website, RadioLiberty.com, if you'd like to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or any of our DVDs or talks on the Financial Armageddon, Financial Tsunami, or certainly Ed Griffin's wonderful book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, or Mr. Walther's book, The Coming Battle, written in 1899. He's telling you exactly what's going on today. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Now, I want to remind you that the Radio Liberty annual seminar is going to be held on the 17th of October. That's just 2 weeks from this Sunday. We're bringing in speakers from across America. We've got some great speakers coming. We're going to be serving lunch. It's going to Doors are open at 8. We'll get started promptly at 8:30. We'll go till 5 or a little later. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You have to have reservations because we're serving lunch. And we do hope that you'll come and bring people who may not quite understand what's going on. But there's information there. We'll have our tables, and this and other people will have tables there, where you can get information and then obtain knowledge. And then, of course, we hope that you'll encourage people to listen to our radio programs at radioliberty.com on the internet. They can get them. Of course, they can be heard on shortwave. They can be heard on satellite. And then, of course, we have our radio Liberty Network. Our programs are heard certainly in Flint, Michigan, and in Lansing, Michigan, and in upstate New York, and Utica, Attica, in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Lexington, Kentucky. We are reaching people all across America. And then, of course, we have our shortwave hookup, our internet hookup, our satellite. If you'd be interested in knowing more about satellite, go to our Radio Liberty website. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, because we are indeed on the front lines of this spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's got to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And well, our special guest here on Friday evening is William Grieg. William, thanks very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me once again.
Well, it's always a pleasure. William Grieg used to be the senior editor of the New American Magazine. Now he has his own radio program, his own blog, and are heard regularly here at Radio Liberty on Friday evening. So what are we going to be talking about?
There are a number of things I think are worthy of our attention, the first of which is a very sad but, of course, inevitable development, that is the passing of the late Joseph Sobrin. I wanted to remark about that just briefly because I think that he was the finest political essayist of our generation. As a matter of fact, it's difficult to find his like in 20th century history in terms of the elegance of his style, the concision of his writing, and the courage that he displayed in defense of the principles that he professed. He was somebody who suffered professionally a great deal because he took a principled stand against the Iraq War in 1990 and 1991 that eventually cost him his position at the National Review magazine. And he had been enjoying a fairly lucrative post there as their senior editor. He was responsible for most of the unsigned content of that magazine. And he, as a matter of devotion to constitutional rule and conservatism as defined by the preservation of national independence and a way of life that's rooted in our Christian heritage, he understood that, as James Madison pointed out, of all the greatest enemies of public liberty, war is the most to be feared. And so he was very skeptical. He became very skeptical, in any case, of the exercise of military power by the government of Washington. And that put him at loggerheads with the Washington-based conservative political establishment. They've become pretty much an appendage of the regime in Washington. William F. Buckley, the former, and I put that in scare quotes, CIA operative who founded National Review, is somebody who way back in 1952 said that in the context of the Cold War with Soviet Russia, we would have to put up with what he called a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores for the duration of that protracted emergency. And after the apparent collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989 through 1991, Buckley and the people around him found another excuse to maintain that totalitarian bureaucracy. As a matter of fact, they found a succession of excuses, the most recent of which is the so-called war on terror. But they were hunting desperately for some kind of a unifying element to justify the preservation of this distended and corrupt apparatus of power in Washington. And Sobrin asked, of course, the impertinent but necessary questions about what was going on in that interval in which it seemed as if we were going to be able to disentangle ourselves from all these multilateral organizations and all these long-standing international commitments. He wasn't on message. He wasn't on the reservation, as one person once chided him.
Hold that thought. Hold that. Go ahead. Go ahead.
And because he insisted on being independent in his perspective and true to his principles, Mr. Sobrin ended up losing a great deal professionally and spending the rest of his altogether too brief life suffering the penury that often is the companion of honest endeavor. And he's passed away. He's gone to be with the Lord. And I'm happy in that respect, but I'm still very furious over the way he was treated, and I'm going to miss him terribly.
Well, I think that people have to understand that freedom of the press does not mean that you're not going to be mistreated, that you're not going to be persecuted by the conservative establishment if you tell the truth. But remember, we have an obligation to tell the truth. We have the right to speak out. There will be terrible problems if you do. This has happened to a number of people I've known. They've been blacklisted, but they have their integrity. Well, go right ahead, William.
I really appreciate you bringing up the question of integrity here and how if you're willing to sell your soul, you'll always find that you're doing that in the buyer's market. It's always to the advantage of the purchaser and never to the vendor if you engage in that transaction. And one of the reasons why I wanted to pay tribute to Mr. Sobrin, apart from the fact that I really respect him as a defender of individual liberty and dignity as defined by God's law, and also as somebody who is a critic of all the right institutions that are assaulting that imperishable and indispensable gift, which is individual freedom and dignity once again. One reason I wanted to focus on that is because he is somebody who lived a life of integrity. I didn't always agree with Mr. Sobrin, and quite frankly, he didn't always agree with himself. He retained the sovereign right to change his mind whenever he encountered an argument that struck him as persuasive, or whenever he got the facts wrong. He didn't change his principles, but he changed his mind about specific issues that represented applications of principle. And as you said, Dr. Stan, there are many people who have had to make really hard choices about what they really believe and whether they're going to be faithful to the principles that they have espoused and articulated in public, or if they're going to trim their sails, cut their corners, or otherwise make an accommodation in a way that's friendly to their career. And one thing that Mr. Sobrin's experience illustrates is something that relatively few people appreciate, and that is that this instrumentality of perception control that you constantly refer to, Dr. Stan, where reality is scoffed at and illusion is king, that's not something which is conducted solely and exclusively by what we call the left wing or the liberal media. Most of the conservative media, whether you're talking about what remains of the print medium or whether you're talking about the major instruments of the national talk radio network and networks, whether you're talking about some of the major publications, These are people who are very, very much compromised in terms of what they will permit, what they will allow, what they will countenance by way of acceptable opinion. You can be pretty certain that if somebody, with a couple of exceptions that I think most people would understand and appreciate, if somebody has his own national program on one of the larger and more notable talk radio networks, for instance, or on Fox News, or if somebody is being published by the Wall Street Journal, chances are that person's made some key compromises with respect to principle in favor of playing a scripted role in this insipid little melodrama that is American electoral politics. Where you have is Carol.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about how many times people compromise what they believe because, of course, they want to get along. Now, that doesn't mean that a man can't change his mind, and he was using the example of Joseph Sobern, who many times would say, well, things have come up, we have to change our minds, and as you were saying that, William, I was thinking, how when I first got started in this movement back in 1962, I mean, I was firmly convinced that communism was the primary enemy threatening America, and then gradually seeing, well, there were other organizations, though, that were threatening America, like the Council on Foreign Relations. And then, of course, I began to find out about the foundations and realized that they were actually funding communism and the communist activities here in the United States. And we had all these members of the Communist Party, and we had some of them in our own community. And they seemed to be enemies of everything we stood for, and they are enemies of everything we stood for. And communism is horrible and brutal. But last night, I really got one of the greatest shocks of my time, of my life. I was talking to a gentleman who was with the FBI for many years, and he writes about certainly the FBI's involvement in so many dishonest and criminal activities. One of the points he made, just very casually, was the fact that the head of the Communist Party, the man that we loved to hate, Gus Hall, of course, his right-hand man, Marcus Childs, they were both FBI informants. Gus Hall was an FBI informant. He headed the Communist Party. And Marcus Childs, number two man, he was also an FBI informant. And then, of course, we see the same thing happening with the IRA over there in Ireland, you know, the Irish Republican Army, and they're setting off bombs in London, and they're killing people. And yet it turns out the number two man in the IRA is a British intelligence agent, and the guy who's there, who's responsible for security for the Irish Republican Army, and he's killing people and torturing them to death, you know, accusing them of being British intelligence agents, and he himself is a British intelligence agent. And then you suddenly, well, maybe it's not so strange that Gus Hall, who headed the Communist Party in America, along with Marcus Childs, was an intelligence agent. That's in the book To Kill a President by Wesley Swearinger, we interviewed last night. You know, nothing as it appears to be, and I think honest men have to be willing to say, hey, I was chasing the wrong enemy, not that communism isn't brutal and inhuman and anti-Christian. It's just simply that it was funded by our great tax-exempt foundations and led by FBI informants.
Yeah, being used as a cat's paw or a stalking horse, being used in terms of controlled opposition, that's a very common thing. You refer to what happened in Europe with the IRA. Another really good example we referred to is, I believe his name was Bristow, the guy who was the head of populist movement in Canada that at the fringe was somewhat flavored by what we'd have to call racist or at least groups that appeared to be espousing racist positions. The so-called heritage, I think it was the heritage movement, the Heritage Party up in Canada. He was an informant. He was a plant being controlled by the NSIS, the Canadian equivalent of sort of a combination of the CIA and the FBI. But there are all kinds of examples you could cite where when you're dealing with somebody who's in a position of influence that way, chances are he's been in some sense compromised, bought off, or put where he is by agents of whatever regime is in power. And the same, of course, is true right now with respect to all these so-called plots having to do with Muslim extremists in this country. And one of the things we talked about last week was this transparently phony plot in Chicago where the FBI, for whatever reason, talent scouted this 20-year-old kid from Lebanon who apparently had no criminal record, no criminal inclinations. But over the course of a year, they paired him up with a provocateur who got the kid talking in terms of all these things he could do if he really wanted to shake up the political establishment in Chicago. And he was talking about, among other things, setting off a bomb that would not have an explosive, but rather would be loaded with notes that would contain ominous warnings, or a dummy bomb that would go off with smoke and noise but not hurt anybody. And after the provocateur got him thinking, if you will, sort of in the subjunctive mood about what he would do in certain circumstances, the FBI sent in a couple of undercover informants who were trained at Quantico, who were posing as financiers, and got this kid so deeply involved in all these things that he probably never would have dreamt of on his own, that he eventually was maneuvered into a position where just a few weeks ago, he deposited a satchel containing with what he thought was a very powerful anti-personnel bomb in a dumpster outside of a bar right next to Wrigley Field while a concert by the Dave Matthews Band was going on. And, of course, he'd been provided with that by his undercover handlers, by the FBI. This phony bomb had been rigged up in Quantico, and now this kid is facing serious charges of plotting to carry out a terrorist act, which was something that had been completely scripted and facilitated by the FBI. That's one really good example of that. Here's another really good example that just came out within the last week or so. Last week, Dr. Stan, we talked about these raids that were conducted by the FBI in Chicago and in Minneapolis, and I think there might have been one or two in Michigan and one or two in North Carolina, having to do with people who were part of sort of the left-wing branch of the anti-war movement. Now, they're not all that anti-war in their outlook. As a matter of fact, as long as the left is in power, they're not particularly worried about war. It's only when the Republicans are in power and the other side's in power that they start talking about the anti-war effort. But there are some elements in that larger movement that are somewhat consistent. They don't particularly like the interventionist foreign policy of Washington. I don't like it either. To that extent, no further, we agree. But they were being sought as potential co-conspirators, supposedly, in plots involving various Middle Eastern and Latin American terrorist groups. So that was going on around the 26th of September. And on the very same day, there was a piece published in the Chicago area entitled Inside the FBI's Terrorism Fight, Making Friends. You skip down about seven or eight paragraphs in the story and read the following. Sheikh Kifa Mustafa, who runs the Mosque Foundation in Bridgeview, asked some of the most pointed questions during the six-week FBI Citizens Academy and trip to Washington. He pushed agents to fully explain everything from the Bureau's use of deadly force policy to racial and ethnic profiling. I saw a very interesting side of what the FBI does, and I wanted to know more, Sheikh Mustafa explained after returning from D.C. He hopes the FBI's outreach runs deeper than positive public relations. The point is, this is a guy who runs an outfit in Chicago that is suspected by some people to be aligned with Hamas. And yet here he was as a visitor, an honored guest, at the FBI's Counterterrorism Center in Washington, in Quantico, rather. Well, he visited the Counterterrorism Center in Washington, D.C., and then visited the training academy at Quantico. So he was actually brought into the Sanctum Sanctorum in Washington, D.C., which is the coordinating agency for counterterrorism, in spite of the fact that back in Chicago, he's somebody who's been associated with people who are believed to be in league with Hamas, which itself was created with the help of the CIA and Israeli intelligence. Now, I don't know whether or not this guy's dirty. What I do know is that it strikes me as inexplicable, if the FBI is really in the business of counterterrorism, that they would be inviting somebody with plausibly alleged ties to Hamas into the Counterterrorism Center in Washington, D.C., while they're sending out SWAT teams to kick down the doors of eccentric and misguided but harmless left-wing activists in places like Minneapolis and in Chicago in the name, supposedly, of fighting terrorism. And so this, once again, is an illustration of something that we talk about pretty consistently on this program, which is the FBI cultivating its own opposition. For all I know, this imam is just a Muslim cleric. He very well could be. He may be somebody who is distantly aligned with Hamas. But in any case, there's a far greater possibility that this guy given his associations, might have something to do, however distantly, with Middle Eastern radicals of that sort, than any of the people who were being persecuted in this dragnet, this crackdown, that occurred at pretty much the same time this guy was in Washington, D.C., as an honored guest of the FBI. But time after time, we see this same scenario unfold. We'll see all the dramatic headlines about the FBI bravely interdicting some terrorist plot. Just in the last week, as a matter of fact, we saw a variation on this theme where we had an urgent but artfully nonspecific threat of a Mumbai-style terrorist assault somewhere in Europe or perhaps the United States. Nobody knows where. Nobody knows exactly who'd be behind it. But they were pretty insistent that it had something to do with Pakistan, and so they unloaded another fuselade of drone-launched Hellfire missiles at targets in Pakistan, and they justified this as a preemptive strike against this supposed plot that would involve a commando-style raid of the sort that took place in India just a couple of years ago. What they don't tell you, first of all, they don't tell you any reason to think that what they're saying is anything other than simply an elaborate cover story for a military action that may have been planned well in advance, or that it's just an empty pretext for a military strike that involves aggression against a country with which we're not at war. We're not at war with Pakistan. Then again, we've never been involved in a declared war since the end of World War II. But they don't tell you about the fact that the terrorist attack in India was facilitated by a guy who was a former agent of both the CIA and the Drug Enforcement Administration, the guy who helped case out the hotel that was attacked in Mumbai, India, David Headley, who went by a pseudonym, is somebody who was an agent of the United States government. And the Indian intelligence agencies, when they wanted to extradite that guy for interrogation, found that the FBI and the CIA wouldn't cooperate. He was their guy. They didn't give him up until they debriefed him and carefully walked back the cat to avoid any damage to the interests that they wanted to preserve among that network that Headley organized and headed up.
Did they ever turn him over to the Pakistanis, do you know?
They eventually turned him over to Indian intelligence, but only after everything he'd been involved in had been scrubbed, pretty much.
All right, and probably he was warned if he ever told the real truth, because who was he really working for? I mean, why would some guy who worked for the CIA be down there casing the hotel at Mumbai, you know, where I think over 100 people were killed, and some of them horribly mutilated, you know, and people trained in Pakistan by an organization, yet the people who control that organization have never been punished. I wonder why. Go right ahead.
These are just some of...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value, plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 3:16 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
To go to war under one circumstance or another, but he was called to Tennessee to testify in the, about a group of Muslims who've lived there in this community for a long period of time. They want to build a mosque. Now, certainly, I don't think that we should have ever encouraged large numbers of Muslims to come to America because it could only create conflicts. On the other hand, if Christians are going to have the right to build their houses of worship, the Muslims should be as well, as long as this is certainly nothing more than simply a house of worship. Mm-hmm. But there is an organized effort, ladies and gentlemen, to turn Americans against Muslims throughout the world. And those living here are simply an easy group to target. And then, of course, they're trying to get Muslims throughout the world to hate America, because I really do believe there's an organized effort to carry out what Samuel Huntington warned against, and that is the clash of civilizations. And it's well worthwhile reading his book, or certainly reading his essay in the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations. You can get that at the local library. And he just says, you know, there are all these different civilizations, the Oriental civilization and the European civilization and the but there is a civilization, a Muslim civilization. And the last thing you want to do is put Western civilization into conflict with the Muslim world. This class of civilization, we can't change them. We would be foolish to try. Mm-hmm. And if we come into a confrontation with the Muslim world, there are going to be terrible consequences for us and for them. And I think Samuel Huntington's advice was excellent. But I think this book was read by many of the elitists who said, say, that sounds like a great way of really tearing down and destroying civilization. Let's go after them. And that's what they're doing. They're trying to turn us against the Muslims and the Muslims against the West. Go ahead.
Yeah, they reverse engineered what he was prescribing here. And that's a very standard modus operandi for the people who run things, I have found. It's almost as if these are people who went to medical school and studied disease in order to propagate it rather than to cure it.
That's a very, very good analogy. Go ahead.
What Miss Gaffney did when he went to Tennessee, he went there trailing clouds of glory because he came from the imperial capital. He's somebody who's seen on television, so we know that he's somebody whose insights we can trust and whose wisdom is unassailable. And he was brought into this courtroom to offer testimony as an expert on Sharia law. Sharia law, of course, being the application of the Muslim faith to all areas of life. It's not uniform, it's not monolithic, but what Mr. Gaffney said is that that is now the enemy threat doctrine that we have to treat as a form of sedition. Now, what he is saying, essentially, is that he wants to see whether he's going to describe it as such, an effective bill of attainder be devised and enforced that would criminalize the Muslim faith. Now, that doesn't strike most people as a particularly threatening thing, because the Muslims in this country are a minuscule and all but powerless minority. They punch above their weight in some areas of the country. For instance, Dearborn, Michigan, there's a large Muslim presence, and it's been enriched by two of the most asinine public policies in the history of human politics. The first is the war on drugs, which provides the steady stream of potential recruits into the largest madrasa in the world, which is the federal government's penal system. The prison system is where most of the Muslim recruitment goes on. You have these people who are sent to prison, usually because of sentence enhancements, that are, in some senses, I contend, de facto racist, when you have higher sentencing guidelines, for instance, with respect to crack cocaine than powder cocaine. And you have all these young black men and young Latino men and young white men being sent to prison and recruited by people who are propagating the Muslim faith. The other big contributing factor to this, of course, is our foreign policy, which churns up trouble in places like Somalia and Iraq and now, of course, Pakistan, Yemen. And where do these people go when trouble erupts and you have missiles being thrown around by remotely piloted drones and American fighting personnel blowing things up in their home countries? A lot of them migrate to the United States. And they end up a place like Dearborn, and they artificially create a demographic surge that results in some minuscule political influence for Muslims. But by and large, you're dealing with a minuscule and largely powerless group that is just a perfect target for demonization by the likes of Gaffney.
Amen. And certainly this is going to accomplish nothing. If we were to take away their right to build a mosque, then, of course, there should be other ability to take away the Christians' right to build their churches. And if we believe in the Constitution, we have to uphold their rights. I'm really surprised Frank doesn't believe in the Constitution and would allow himself to be used as a pawn in this game, or maybe he's one of the players. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Ahead.
One of the reasons I wanted to focus on this issue, Dr. Stan, is because of the principle that you articulated just before the break, which is that if we abridge the freedoms of people who are powerless, relatively powerless, and numerically insignificant, you, of course, are enhancing the power of the government to abridge the freedoms of anybody. One of the things that is going on here in this effort essentially to criminalize the Islamic faith is they're taking advantage of the fact that you're dealing with a small and largely powerless, almost entirely powerless minority, except, of course, for Dearborn, Michigan, which seems to be the exception that's always thrown in the face of people who are defending the rights of individuals who profess that faith. And when Gaffney went to Murfreesboro, he was there for the purpose of trying to get the county government to recognize and to act on the assumption that the Islamic faith itself is a form of seditious ideology, and that the only way that somebody could practice that faith, presumably, is if he did so within what amounts to a temporary prison, or better yet, that nobody in this country, or nowhere in this country, could people practice that faith. Now, once again, I have no brief for that faith, but I have to subscribe to Jefferson's view that what a man thinks about God is a business that he and God will have to sort out. But as long as he neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg, he's not committing aggression against me. unfortunately, that's not the principle that obtains right now when you've got the post-Buckley, Beltway-centered, militarist, collectivist conservatism as the dominant species of that ideology. They're always looking for an enemy, and as Gaffney said, this is the new enemy threat doctrine, what they call Sharia law. It's a caricature, quite frankly, of Sharia law that Mr. Gaffney's talking about. But bear in mind, Gaffney, as a supporter of the Iraq War, actively promoted Sharia because the Constitution inflicted on Iraq, which was a largely secular country, that new Constitution written by Americans and enforced at the point of American bayonets and missiles enshrined Sharia law as the law of that country.
Hold the thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and the point that William is making is so very, very clear. You know, here we go to war with Iraq because we want to bring them freedom. And what do? Why, of course, we install a constitution there now. Of course, they say, well, it was written by the Iraqis. But does anybody really believe, other with, you know, 100,000 and 150,000 American troops there, armed to the teeth, you know, then we're directing everything going on. We're paying the salaries. We're funding everything. We're funding the government. Does anybody believe that they wrote an independent constitution? And one of the things that, of course, most Americans don't understand is that certainly under the wicked Saddam Hussein, where they had a secular society, they had a system of law where Christians could live and live equal to everybody else. Once the heroic Americans had gone in there, why we installed a constitution that had Sharia law in it, which has forced the Christians to flee from the country. And the Christians of Iraq now are living in Syria, they're living in Jordan, anything to get away from the Sharia law installed by the courageous American troops. Now, I don't mean our fighting men. Our fighting men are very brave, but they're being used by evil and wicked people who wanted to install a government under Sharia law, which is in total violation of everything America stands for and for what so many brave Americans had fought and died. But they were betrayed by their political leaders, what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. Well, before we go on, William, I want you to go ahead and tell our listeners how they can get your website, how they can simply get and listen to your programs, and then how they can get to your PayPal button and perhaps help support you, because I really believe William is doing a yeoman's job, and we need him out there on the front lines writing on a regular basis and doing his own radio program for which he doesn't get paid. So go right ahead.
Dr. Stan, I sure appreciate that. My blog is called Pro Libertate, and it's found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Another way to get to it is to go to a search engine. Google, of course, is the dominant search engine right now. And type in my name, William Grigg, and Pro Libertate, ProLiberTate. Some combination of my name and Pro Libertate will probably turn up my blog as the first return. My radio program is also called Pro Libertate Radio. It's broadcast every Saturday night on the Liberty News Radio Network, libertynewsradio.com. I'm on from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time, which is 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock Pacific, or 9 o'clock to midnight in the Central Time Zone. Liberty News Radio is growing in terms of its profile in terrestrial radio. If you go to the website, libertynewsradio.com, there's a list of affiliates as well for those who want to listen to it, not only online but in terrestrial form. And anybody who can do anything to help Liberty News Radio grow, I would sure appreciate a little bit of help in that respect. But it's available by way of streaming on the Internet as well. And there are podcasts that are downloadable from the archives of all the programs at Liberty News Radio. And as you mentioned, Dr. Stan, my website does have a function, a PayPal function, for those who have the means and inclination to help out. And as you pointed out, this is how I'm supporting my family right now. I really do appreciate the fact that you give me the opportunity to point this out to your listeners, because many of them have been very generous to us. God bless you. It's been very rewarding and more a little bit humbling to know that there are people who value what I do and what we are trying to do in terms of speaking the truth as we're given the wisdom to understand it through independent means. I mean, that's the blessing of the time we live in right now, is that one can be a self-published and self-promoted media presence if you can find a niche and if you're persistent enough to work it. And that's something that wasn't the case less than a generation ago, half a generation ago, we couldn't be doing that kind of thing. That's the blessing. The burden, of course, is that because you're independent, you have to find some way to support yourself. And the fact that there are people who have imparted to us so generously, to me and to my family, is something for which I will always be grateful. Thank you so much, and God bless you.
Well, we appreciate so much for doing, William, and we're just pleased to have an opportunity to let our listeners hear, you know, about your needs and certainly what you're doing. Well, let's go ahead then with the story. We've been talking about this whole idea to demonize the Muslim faith. And
Yeah. What
people have to understand, you can't have a war unless you've got people who hate one another.
Yep.
And basically, the Muslims have never been a threat to the West. I mean, what happened on September 11th, if there was really had happened exactly as we have been told, then the day on September 12th, they would have closed the southern border so the wicked Islamic terrorists couldn't come across the border and blow up our towns, blow up our railways, set fire to our forests. And yet none of these things have happened. So there really is not a threat. In fact, almost every one of the threats that has happened here seems to have had either government support, our own government, or this one incident recently where some young man went over to Pakistan, was trained on how to build a bomb. But how could they have possibly done such a poor job unless this whole thing was a setup? And once again, he was a patsy. They taught him how not to build a bomb. He did not build a bomb. It did not go off in Times Square. And he'll spend the rest of his life in prison, just exactly like the Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. He was going to blow up an airplane by lighting the fuse to the explosives in his shoe. But they were C4, and they don't go off with the fuse. You have to have an electronic impulse to set off the C4, or the underwear bomber, once again using C4, trying to light himself a fire so that he could blow up the plane. But the trouble is that C4, you have to have an electronic impulse. I mean, somebody is giving these terrorists terribly bad advice, and I don't see how that can be, because actually we train so many members of Al-Qaeda exactly in explosives. They must have forgot everything they learned, and these people they're training, every one of them, why, there's a terrible threat, but nothing happens. And ladies and gentlemen, ask yourself, why haven't we had more real acts of terrorism other than those created by the agent provocateurs? Why have they never closed the border? Why on September 11th were no fighter planes allowed to intercept the hijacked planes? And why, if you look at both the Shanksville, where the plane crashed, and the Pentagon, where the plane crashed, there was no wreckage at either site. I mean, the wreckage at Shanksville was 8 miles away, but it wasn't there where the plane crashed. How could the plane have crashed directly into the ground and literally no wreckage there? How could that gigantic plane have gone into the Pentagon and no wreckage outside? Well, go ahead.
You bring up the fact that we had the string of almost comically inept attempts involving C4 or involving a dud bomb that didn't go off in the case of the Times Square non-bombing. One thing about the Times Square incident that I think nobody knows, I mean, next to nobody, there are a handful of people who know this, but this is an instance in which everybody involved in security, whether you're talking about the federal counterterrorism people, the Homeland Security people, the local police, nobody in a position of official responsibility for security did anything to interdict that plot. And what happened is that when that supposed bomb was recognized, the individual who recognized that this appeared to be a bomb and then tipped off the authorities was a Muslim. He was a local citizen of New York, a longtime resident. I don't know if he was born here or an immigrant, but the guy who actually provided the tip that there was what appeared to be a bomb about to go off in Times Square was a local Muslim. And so you're dealing with a situation where the fellow who went to Pakistan and was trained by somebody who almost certainly has some connection, either intimate or reasonably close, to the CIA, because the ISI intelligence agency of Pakistan is, for all intents and purposes, an appendage of the CIA. They're the ones who've been involved in training and facilitating Al-Qaeda. It's been that way for over 25, 30 years now, quite frankly. But this guy went over there and, as you point out, was taught how not to make a bomb, when he was asked about his motivation in court, what he said was that he doesn't like the fact that the United States government is making war on Muslims. That's the same thing that's being said by Anwar al-Awlaki, the individual who was born in, I believe, in Yemen, but raised in New Mexico. He's a naturalized... Wait a second. No, I think he was actually born in New Mexico, but he has joint U.S. Yemeni citizenship. He's since gone back to the Arabian Peninsula, and he's the subject of a summary execution order signed by Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, as if he had the authority to do this. There was a legal challenge filed on behalf of Anwar al-Awlaki by his father that recently was the subject of a reply by the Obama administration, in which they said, in so many words, that whether or not Anwar al-Awlaki is subject to an execution order, a summary execution order issued by the President of the United States, the courts have no business even asking these questions because of the state secrets doctrine. In other words, the President supposedly has the right to order the summary execution, and the courts have no business reviewing it, and we can't even discuss this matter because it's supposedly protected by the spurious state secrets privilege doctrine. But Mr. al-Awlaki, in his public speeches, first of all, he's denied that he's been involved in training terrorists or in encouraging attacks against the United States or its citizens. But he does say that he's involved in what he calls jihad against the United States government because, once again, the government of the United States is pursuing a foreign policy that results in deaths of non-combatants. Now, I don't know whether Mr. al-Awlaki is a jihadist of the sort who would see attacks on American citizens eventually as being part of that defensive struggle. We are talking about citizens being targeted by reprisal attacks the way that the CIA created Osama bin Laden, supposedly authorized in his fatwa back in 1998. I don't know whether Mr. al-Awlaki is that kind of a person. What I do know is that the President of the United States does not have the constitutional authority to sign an execution warrant for a U.S. citizen who's never been formally charged with a crime of any sort. But that's a really good example of what we're talking about in terms of the way this plays out in policy terms. You've got the government of the United States, which for decades has been propping up the worst elements in the Muslim world, the dictatorships that create huge festering pools of resentment. You're talking about people in Egypt, you're talking about the Saudis, you're talking about charming people in Africa and the Near East who've been on the payroll of the United States. The government of Tehran, Iran, was overthrown in 1953 with the help of the CIA and British intelligence. They went around in the various mosques recruiting the most militant and anti-Western elements they could find in order to foment a revolution that overthrew the Mossadegh regime and installed the Shah. And then 25 years later, guess what happened? Those same people were out on the streets again bringing down the Shah and installing Ayatollah Khomeini. And that's been a pattern in the Muslim world and in the Arab world. I mean, Iran is not a Muslim country. They're Persians, not Arabs, but they're part of they're a Muslim country, a Shiite country. And now we find ourselves in a really peculiar situation where the Saudis, who of course are Sunni Muslims, are actively, albeit quietly, collaborating in this unmistakable tropism towards a war with Shiite Iran. And this is the sort of a thing that just drives me nuts because it's perfectly Orwellian. Washington overthrew a relatively secular government that was nominally Sunni Arab, Sunni Muslim, in Iraq, thereby enhancing the threat that Iran, as a Shiite government, is supposedly represented to American interests, because now you've got a Shiite-dominated Iraq right next door to a Shiite-dominated Iran. Something that means that Iran's a bigger threat, which means that we're going to cooperate more closely with the Sunni monarchy in Riyadh as a way of bringing down the Shiite menace that Washington helped to foment. You know, that's exactly the dynamic that Orwell talked about in 1984.
Yes. I think that's so true. Basically, we install the Shia, regime in Iran. We installed the Shia regime in Iraq because before that it was basically under Sunni control. So basically we overthrew two Sunni states. We installed Shia states. Now we can have a great conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis. But go right ahead.
Yeah, and so you end up with a situation now where we're likely to have a hugely devastating, by hugely devastating, I mean we're talking about something that's like an extinction level event, potentially, for the world economy, if we end up with the situation where the Saudis, as is suspected they will, would passively collaborate in what would likely be a scenario involving an Israeli strike on Iran that would lead, of course, to shutting down the Gulf and creating an oil shock that would destroy what pretty much remains of the industrial economy of the United States and the rest of the Western world. But this is the sort of thing, once again, that Orwell was talking about in terms of this triangular war that was being used for the purpose of keeping three totalitarian regimes in a state of symbiotic, corrupt equipoise, where two would be at war with the other, and there's this shifting, kaleidoscopic range of alliances. And the interesting thing about 1984 and Orwell's premise here is that it very much resembles, many people think that it was inspired directly by a work published by James Burnham called The Managerial Revolution, way back in the early 1940s. Mr. Burnham, at the time, was a Trotskyite communist, and he was the one who talked about the idea of managing world affairs through a state of low-grade, perpetual crisis and perpetual hostility and conflict. And then within the next 10 or 12 years, after writing that book, Mr. Burnham became the intellectual mentor, one of two or three intellectual mentors of a young man who was a Yale graduate and a CIA agent who served in Mexico briefly by the name of William F. Buckley, Jr. He and Wilmore Kendall, who was also a CIA asset, were the people who more or less formed William F. Buckley's worldview. And he created a new form of conservatism that was based on the idea of losing gracefully in the struggle to rein in the government. He talked a good game, as conservatives now often do, about the need to set one's face like flint against the encroachments of the state, except, of course, when the state's actually involved in killing people. And when the state's involved in killing people, when the state has identified a foreign enemy or a new foreign enemy threat doctrine, then it's the duty of all conservatives to set aside, of course, on a temporary basis, their compunctions against government power and government conscription of resources and even direct conscription of manpower through the draft and all this. We have no choice but to support for the duration, just for the duration, mind you, this totalitarian bureaucracy within our own shores that William F. Buckley talked about in his 1952 Commonweal article. That, unfortunately, is conservatism today.
But unfortunately, I mean, certainly we all rallied behind the government in their war against communism, and
yep.
This is why I backed the war in Vietnam. And looking back, I say, how could I have been so foolish? Because all during the Vietnam War, we were financing the Russians, who were financing and providing the military weapons for, and the North Vietnam was giving their weapons to South Vietnam and to the Viet Cong so they could kill our boys. And it's exactly what's going on today. That was a phony war. It took me, I didn't want to admit it. I honestly felt that anybody who opposed the war was a dirty communist. You know, it's very humbling, you know, when you realize how foolish, how we can be manipulated. Hopefully we're on the right side. We can see, we've learned, William and I, and I hope our listeners begin to realize that we are constantly being manipulated. We must see reality as it really is. And now you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Dr. Stan, thanks once again. It's always a pleasure and a blessing to have a chance to talk with you.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-Dry Guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.